You're listening to the Irish Times Roisin Meets podcast.
Welcome back to Roisin Meets. Today we have a very special episode for you. It's our first ever recording of the podcast in front of a live audience, and I have to say it was a great success. Thanks in no small part to my amazing guest. Tara Westover grew up in the US state of Idaho, preparing for the end of days, watching for the sun to darken, for the moon to drip as if with blood. She spent her summers canning peaches and her winters rotating emergency supplies, hoping that when the world of men failed, her family could continue on unaffected. She hadn't been registered for a birth certificate, her father didn't believe in doctors or hospitals, and she'd no school records because she'd never set foot in a classroom. In spite of all this, by the age of 17, Tara was determined to get an education. She worked hard and won a place at the Mormon Brigham Young University before winning a scholarship to the elite Cambridge University in the UK. And less than a decade later, she had completed her PhD and written her really incredible memoir, which is called Educated. Tara was in Dublin to promote that brilliant book this week, and I met her at the Gutter Bookshop in Temple Bar with a lovely audience to hear all about it. Tara, some of the people here will have read the book and will know exactly what I'm talking about when I say how extraordinary it is. But for those who haven't, can you tell us a bit about your very unusual, I think is an okay word to use, childhood growing up in Idaho?
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here. Never been to Dublin before, so it's exciting for me. So I was born and raised, the youngest of seven children, on a really beautiful mountain in southern Idaho. But my father had some unusual beliefs. And because of the beliefs that he had, we were a bit isolated. So because he was opposed to public education, I was never put in school. And because he was opposed to what he called the medical establishment, we never went to the doctor. So I was never allowed to go to the doctor or to a nurse. And I also didn't get a birth certificate until I was nine. And because I didn't go to school and I had never been to a doctor and I was born at home, effectively what that meant was that according to the state of Idaho and the federal government, I didn't exist.
That is quite an introduction. And the other thing was that your father is it radical Mormonism? Is that the label that is attached?
It's kind of complicated because, I mean, people want to say fundamentalist Mormon, but that implies polygamy because mainstream Mormons don't practice polygamy. But my father also didn't practice polygamy. So I call him a survivalist. I do that because I don't think Mormonism is the salient fact. He was Mormon, but I mean, mainstream Mormons believe in public education. They believe in doctors and hospitals. It's a faith like any other faith. So I've developed a theory over the years that possibly he has some kind of mental disorder. And it's been my opinion for quite some time now that the mental disorder causes the religious extremism and not the other way around. So I always try to kind of downplay the Mormon element because to me, it's not the relevant factor.
So it's almost like the religion is the sort of vehicle by which he...
I think it's exactly that. It's actually a word I've used in the past. Yeah, I think it was a vehicle for his extremism, but I don't think it was the cause of it.
Okay. It's a beautifully written book and the descriptions are amazing. I mean, you grew up in this quite incredible sort of countryside and the big mountain there, and you describe that so well. And also you had grandparents living nearby. And there's one really incredible scene at the beginning where one of your grandparents, your grandmother, like tries to offer a way to get Tara to escape and to take her away from all of that. I found that really moving because here's a woman who could see what was going on. And there you were six or seven at the time.
Yeah, I was seven. My grandmother, because it was my father's mother, was one of the few people who would just regularly challenge him, I think, with no fear whatsoever. And they had a little mobile home they went to in the winters in Arizona. And she came up with this great idea that effectively she would just kidnap me and take me to Arizona and put me in school. And because my dad was so busy working, he had a junkyard, he had to work a lot before it snowed to try to make enough money to get through the winter. She was just banking on the fact that he wouldn't be able to come get me until, you know, some future date. By which point, I think she hoped I would really love school and that somehow a miracle would happen and I'd be allowed to go.
But you, this little 6-7-year-old, there's a scene where you're actually looking out the window. Your granny waits for you for a couple of hours. Like you can see her looking up and then you're just looking down going, I'm not going. Do you remember that very vividly?
I do remember it because it was a real choice. I mean, I had my father's opinions. They were completely my opinions. I thought the public school was corrupt and wicked because he told me that and I had never been. So I assumed. But I was curious about it and I did want to go and I wanted to be like other kids in my town. So there was a bit of a conflict there. But ultimately, I mean, my identity with my family and that internal world, those were the people I trusted. You know, even my grandmother was an outsider because she went to the doctor. And as far as I was concerned, that was not all right.
I describe the book as an achievement. I really do think it is because, I mean, this is not, for anyone who hasn't read it, it's not misery lit. I just have to let everyone know that because I've read quite a bit of that and I don't really like it. But this is not that. Tara doesn't demonize. I actually don't think you demonize your family at all. But I would like to talk about your dad a bit more because, again, quite an unusual person. But this junkyard you spoke about, which when you got to a certain age, you had to work on. Can you tell us about that experience? Because essentially he was chucking bits of metal over in your direction. And this was, he had no sort of health and safety sort of manuals going on, did he, at all? Like, and no danger sort of filter.
I think it's hard for people to grasp this. And I've tried to explain it as many ways as I can. As a child, I would say I was missing some information that I needed to understand what was happening. So my dad, he just didn't have the bone in his head that would say to any other person, don't do this. This is a very dangerous thing to do. Do it a different way. And I think it was, again, I have this theory about bipolar. I'm not sure what it was, but it was something. I know for sure it wasn't that he didn't care about us. But for some reason, he was never able to evaluate risk. Even after something bad had happened, he didn't seem able to realize, oh, that happened because there wasn't a safety harness. Oh, that happened because I didn't look where I was throwing that. That happened because of any one of things that he could have done differently. And I really do think it was a mental kind of defect of some kind. And I think, but as a child, I didn't know that. I didn't have that category. As a child, I thought you could either be sane or you could be insane. And I didn't understand that there were things that you could be functional and something could still be wrong. So when something like that would happen, you know, he would ask me to do something that I knew was dangerous. And then I would try to do it and I would often get hurt. My siblings would get hurt. And I would experience those things as being kind of my fault. I mean, there was this one incident where he had me climb into a bin of scrap that he was going to dump. And then he was thinking, oh, I'll pause for a second and let you climb out of the scrap. When it gets up level to the trailer, I'll let you crawl out and you can run over to the cabin and then you'll be safe and I'll dump it. But the problem is while he was moving it, something shifted in the bin and it just pierced right through my leg, a big piece of jagged metal, and it just held me in place. And of course, this is a giant diesel engine. It was essentially a forklift with an extendable boom, very loud. I was shouting to him. He couldn't hear me. So he paused thinking I was climbing out, but I wasn't climbing out. I was stuck. And he ended up dumping the bin while I was inside of it. And luckily, I was able to, once the metal fell out of my leg, I fell over the side and I fell quite far, but I was okay. I mean, I had a big hole in my leg. But I experienced that at the time with a lot of guilt, actually, and a bit of shame and wondering why I couldn't do this thing he'd asked me to do. Because I had that information. My father loves me. He asked me to do something. I couldn't do it. The fault must be mine. And the information I didn't have was my father loves me. My father can care about my safety, but he might not be able to keep me safe. Like, I didn't have that bit of information that could square that circle.
And meanwhile, your mother, another very interesting person and a very, it seems to me, I mean, you're obviously, we'll talk about it a bit more, but intellectually very bright. And your mother, I think also, it seems to me from the book as well in some ways. But tell me about her and the fact, you talk about your dad possibly being mentally ill, but you don't necessarily think your mother was. But what kind of a person is she, was she?
I think of her as, people use a lot of different words. People like to call her a survivor, an enabler. I think she is someone who made a decision very early on in her marriage about how she was going to deal with her husband's radicalism and how she wanted that to look to the outside world. And I think initially that probably just required small things that probably didn't seem like they mattered very much. But over time, I think it required big things. So initially, I think it just required if my father said something to my grandmother, you know, my mother's mother, that was upsetting, my mother would smooth it over or tell her maybe she hadn't heard it right or something. But over time, I think especially as the homeschool started to erode and there stopped being much education going on, I think it was a more active kind of deception of kind of pretending to her parents that things were, that there was a school happening when there wasn't. And then ultimately, you know, it would get very complicated with my relationship with them and why that would kind of begin to fall apart after I went to Cambridge.
Mm. And the thing about it was that basically you were preparing for the end of days. This was the thing. So can you explain to us about that, about stockpiling all the stuff and about it was this constant idea that the world was going to end and that you had to be ready and all that kind of stuff. So I mean, presumably that was just normal for you. That was just the way your life was. But what does it mean as a kid?
I mean, my dad was very much a believer that, you know, before the second coming, there would be this apocalyptic event. And I think this is theologically present in a lot of religions. It's not unique to Mormons. And I don't think Mormons take it a great deal more seriously than most people. They kind of believe in it, but it doesn't impact their day to day that much. Whereas my dad, it definitely impacted his day to day. He was constantly preparing for it. And we were canning food. We were canning peaches. Summer to me, I really thought canning season was a season. I thought that's what it was called, you know, because that's what my mother would say. Oh, it's almost canning season, or we have to do this before canning season ends. I mean, I never called it, you know, summer was canning season, and it was a distinct season in it because it took part of summer and a lot of the fall. And so we did a lot of that, burying fuel tanks, rotating water, all kinds of just any kind of emergency supply situation that you would need. There was a period my dad learned Morse code and even my brother and I tried to learn it and yeah, all kinds of just.
And as you got older, you know, your relationship with your family, I mean, how many of there were you again?
So I had six siblings. There were nine of us, my parents and seven children.
And as you got older, did you start to, even though you had no other world experience, this was your world, did things start to seem different and your relationship with your brother started to become very bad? Can you tell us a bit about that and how that affected kind of the way you thought about your family?
So I had, pretty much when I was a child, I only had access to my father's perspective. So his way of seeing the world was just the way that I saw the world. And I mean, when I was 16, that's when I decided to try to educate myself and through a bunch of, I don't know, I'm sure how it happened, but somehow I learned enough math and enough grammar to scrape through this exam and be admitted to Brigham Young University. And that was, I was 17. It was the first time I'd been in a classroom. But that was a big moment because I started to get access to different perspectives. And I think that can start with things like history. I'd only had access to my father's version of history, which really wasn't a lot of history. And one of my first lectures I was in, I raised my hand and asked what the Holocaust was. I had not heard of it. And
people thought you were being
People thought I was being
rude.
Anti-Semitic. They thought I was denying it, I think. They heard it as, what is this? And I meant it as, what is this?
What's that word you used? I think that's what you said. What's that word again? And everyone was just like,
it didn't go down great. But, you know, I think in a way, learning about history, I learned about the civil rights movement, which I had never learned before. And of course, my family used a racial slur. They used the N-word quite a lot. It was actually a word my older brother used for me. And that changed how I saw not just a distant history, but a history that was playing out in my own family. Mm. And so I think what that gave me in a way was the ability to have my own perspective on the past, my own perspective on history that was different from the perspective my father had. And I'd never had that before. And I think that's, maybe it was extreme in my case, but I do think it's a universal experience. Part of what it means to grow up is learning to define yourself, both in connection to your parents, but also in distinction to your parents. And for me, that was a skill that I was beginning to develop. And that would become important because I did have this really turbulent relationship with my older brother. And it had been violent for a long time. And, you know, he could be so kind and so sensitive, but he could also be incredibly cruel and manipulative and controlling. And he also had this ability to, which I think everyone, if you're going to have an abusive relationship with someone, you have to do, which is he was very good at distorting reality. You know, I have this theory that all abuse, no matter what kind it is a distortion and an assault on the mind. And he was so good. In the moment that something had happened, within 5 minutes, he could convince you that it hadn't happened or that it meant something different than it had. And I think that there was something in the studying of history and getting my own perspective and learning how to hold on to my own ideas in the face of other people having different ideas really began to chip away at his ability to convince me of what he thought had happened or what he wanted me to think had happened.
Because you kept diaries all through your childhood, and you write about in the book that at some points you're looking at them back and you're basically regurgitating some version of events that he had told you. It's really interesting because you just took it all on.
Well, there was an incident when I was 17 when I had a friend with me, actually. His name was Charles, and it was Thanksgiving, and for whatever reason, my brother was very angry about this, and he, before the meal had even started, he grabbed hold of my hair and he hauled me down the hallway and he shoved my head in the toilet. And when it was all over, he came into my room and he said, "Oh, I'm really sorry. We were having such a fun game and I didn't even realize I'd hurt you. So next time we're having fun, please make sure that you, you know, say something if there's something wrong." And I took his perspective on board 100%, so much so that I tried to convince my friend that that's what had happened. And of course, I mean, I had no success with it because he knew what he had seen. But he also knew that there was no point trying to reason with me because I think he could see how deeply I was, how far I was really under my brother's power. But there was another incident that happened not that long after. Very similar. My brother attacked me in a parking lot. And for some reason, and again, this is when I was at the university, after that incident, I went home and I described it in my journal. And I wrote what had happened. And I wrote that I'd been afraid. And I wrote that I'd been angry. And I wrote that I would have torn my brother apart if I'd been able to, because that's how much I hated him in that moment. And while I was writing that, he knocked on my door. And he came in and he said, "It was just a game. And I had no idea that I was even hurting you. And next time we're having fun, will you be sure to tell me if something's wrong?" And he left. And I wrote in my journal that night, I didn't know what was right. I didn't know whether his experience was right and it had been a game, or whether my experience was right. But I knew that there'd been two experiences. I knew I wasn't having fun. Whatever he was having, I wasn't. And I think it was the first time that that had happened, that after that process of my brother attempting to dominate me in that way, there were still two minds present, like two distinct minds, not one mind having got control over another.
And this all sort of started when he saw you smudging sort of your sister's mascara, your older sister's mascara on you. So was there something about sort of you growing older and becoming, you know, like a woman? I used to call you a whore a lot, like that was one of the words. And you mentioned shame, and there's a lot of that through this kind of the relationship throughout the family, really.
Yeah, I think he did have a lot, he struggled a lot more with me, and that hostility definitely grew as I became older. And I think that that probably has to do with, I don't know if it's a deeply rooted sexism, or I think it probably had a lot to do with his own guilt towards himself and the way that he felt about himself. I don't necessarily, in the book, and I don't do it in my own life, over-psychologize that and try to figure out exactly why that was happening, because I don't feel like I need to know why it was happening. I know it did happen. And I don't necessarily try to figure out exactly why he was doing that.
You talked about getting the grades to go to university and actually making that. I mean, you talked about it very sort of briefly there, but it's quite amazing to me in reading it that you actually get out of this scenario. You know, I know your older brother had gone to college, so that was something that you could look up to and see. But the fact that they let you go and you were able to do it, and the fact you had to go and find these books, you had to do it yourself to scrape through these exams. What was the sort of driving force going on with you there? Was it like, I need to get out of here at that point? Was that the feeling?
I didn't want to work in my dad's scrapyard anymore. I had this really turbulent relationship with my brother, who, even if I was lying to myself about what it was, and I was lying to myself about it, I still wanted to get away from it, I think. And then I think, even though there was something really painful and miserable about being at BYU, because I was still isolated, I was with all these mainstream Mormons and I wasn't mainstream, and I was judging them a lot because they wore clothes I thought were immodest and watched movies I thought were not okay, and even the food they ate I thought wasn't quite Mormon enough. And it's true.
What's Mormon food?
I mean, some Mormons believe you're not allowed to drink Coke or Pepsi. And of course, my family is, if there's a way to interpret things more strictly, we will absolutely do that.
Well, I'm sure they must have been judging you a bit, because you didn't really know much about personal hygiene.
I wasn't great either. No, but ironically, that was the thing. I think they probably judged me less than I was judging them, and they had more cause. It was hard, and it was socially hard, and it was academically a nightmare, and I'd never written an essay and I'd never taken an exam. But even putting all that aside, it was really exciting. And, you know, after I learned about the Holocaust, I took an entire course on Jewish history. And that was having that option to kind of realize that there was a gap, there's something I could learn about and learn about it. You know, it was really, the world started to feel like a much bigger place than it had before. And that can be addicting.
I mean, you hold the book Educated, and obviously that's because that's what you're interested in. You have a very good line where you say education shouldn't be about making a living, it should be about making a person. And it's like as though you got to 17, you'd never been in a classroom, and you started to build yourself. You started to make the person that is now Tara Westover. I mean, which is not an experience that most people get to do, because we're stuck in school and we're told to learn this. And we're not told to learn this because that's something you're interested in. We're told to learn it because that's what you're supposed to learn. So you've had a completely different kind of perspective on that.
Well, I think of education, I mean, it's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is because I wanted to put forward an idea of what an education is that isn't about classrooms or worksheets or exams, or all the things that we think of when we think of an education, I think are not an education. In my view, there's two things about education. There's the idea of it, the ideal, which is the individual's pursuit of knowledge, understanding, truth. And then there is the human institution by which we try to achieve that. And that institution can be incredibly cold. It can be passive. It can be corrupted by inequality, bias, all kinds of anything that any human community suffers from, that institution will suffer from. And my worry is that for a lot of people, they've confused the one for the other. You know, there's the idea of what it is, and then there's this kind of flawed way that we approach it. And they're not the same. And, you know, my education experience wasn't, shall we say, perfect. I don't necessarily think that I think my parents took their philosophy too far. But I am grateful that in my household growing up, it's one of the things I do value for my upbringing. The idea that your education, that it was something that you submitted to, never would have occurred to any of us. Education for us, there was something that you undertook for yourself. It was something that you had buy-in for. You had ownership over that. And this belief that any curriculum you build for yourself will be better than one that is built for you, and that you can teach yourself anything better than someone else can teach it to you. These were the ideas of education that I had. And I'm really grateful for that, because I didn't think an education was a conveyor belt that you kind of stood on and you went through this process, this cold, sterile, very institutionalized process. I'm grateful that, for me at least, the conception I had of what an education is was very much the ideal. It wasn't the process.
And I do think, going back to the fact that you say it like it is, you tell the truth about what happened in your family, but you don't demonize them, and you do talk very much about what you got from them. And that is an essential one. Nobody can teach you better than you can teach yourself. That's a really strong message in the book. And I do think it's interesting that they didn't kind of go mad when you went to university. Like, that wasn't the straw that broke the camel's back, or that wasn't the thing that led to the estrangement, because you're estranged from them now, and that's a lot of what the book is about how do you cope when, you know, you're apart, and the people that you have grown up with and that you are closest to in your life don't want to know you anymore. Can you tell us about what it was that led to that?
Well, again, I think it gets back to those ideas of education. I don't think it was the institution of education is not particularly threatening or powerful, but the ideal of education is. The ideal of education, which is something that actually makes you a different person, that's the powerful, vital bit of an education. And that would prove fatal in a way. I think it wasn't easy for my father to accept me going to college. He didn't want me to go. He wanted me to stay home and be an herbalist, maybe even take over, be a midwife like my mother. But we could navigate that. It was tense, but we were making it. But what we couldn't navigate were the changes that happened to me when I began to change and be a different person. And I came to see my relationship with my brother and the violence that was defining of that relationship, really. I started to see that for what it was. And that was because I was a different person who had different ideas about that. I was this person who, when that would happen, it would become harder and harder for that to get downgraded or euphemized or rationalized or justified, because I had my own ideas about it. And that wasn't something I think that my parents and I could negotiate. So when I would confront my parents finally, which is when I was at Cambridge, my dad would decide that I was lying, and he would decide that I was trying to destroy the family. And he would tell my brother what I'd said. And then my brother actually is the one who disowned me. I didn't disown them. He disowned me to begin with. And my parents supported that decision. So the first stage of my estrangement from my family really wasn't my choice.
You mentioned Cambridge there, and it's kind of amazing. I think, you know, you went into school when you were 17, and by 10 years later, you'd done a PhD and an MPhil, and you'd been in Harvard and Cambridge. Like, it's incredible to me. But what really comes out of the book as well is that mentorship, I think, of people you met who believed in you and who could saw something very special in you. Can you tell us a bit about that? About how did you end up in Cambridge and Harvard and all these things?
I'm not privileged
people
not
to
entirely
do that.
Sure. No, I had professors who were incredibly supportive and really just helped me. By the time I'd been at BYU for a while, I began to do fairly well. Not, I wasn't top, but I was doing okay. And I just had some professors who, one in particular at that point, who he ran a study abroad program in Cambridge. I applied because he told me to. I was rejected. He wrote them and said, no, please take the student. And I don't know whether they just didn't want to deal with him or what, but they did. And then while I was there, I met another professor who was at Cambridge, and he just liked my work and made sure that I was able to come back. So I had a really fortunate journey in that sense. But then, of course, there was this tension because the journey that I was undergoing with my education, it was a very different path than the journey with my family. And in a way they were diverging in pretty meaningful ways. I should say not with all my family, but with half. Yeah.
So you have a few people who you're still very close to and you keep in touch with still.
So after my dad responded the way he did after the confrontation, my brother and all of that, there was a period of quite a long time actually where I was estranged from all of my family. And my dad began telling people, especially my family, my immediate family, that I was dangerous. He came up with a theory that I was possessed. And my family, it sounds kind of crazy, but this got traction. I mean, they were raised this way, and that resonated with them for some reason. And it actually was my older brother, Tyler, who was the one who'd encouraged me to go to college, who about 10 months... maybe even a little longer after I had become estranged from them, got in contact with me and said, I want to hear your version, what's happened. And I told him. I had no hope that he would believe me because no one else had. And he did. And it really changed everything. For that 2 years, I'd kind of had a bit of a mental breakdown. And, you know, my parents had set out to discredit me because I think they could not deal with this thing I had said. But the person they'd really succeeded in discrediting me with was myself. I had really begun to wonder if I was crazy. Mm-hmm. And he was, and again, going back to that thing, this idea that all of these kind of distorted relationships, I think all abusive relationships, assaults on the mind, that whole idea. I think for my brother Tyler, what he did is kind of proved that no matter how distorted that reality becomes and how much of the world it seems to have consumed, like one person can stop it. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge moment, maybe one of the biggest moments of my life, when just that powerful thing of when one bystander stops bystanding.
And what did it mean for you? Because you mentioned a mental breakdown and you're at Cambridge, and in some ways you're having this incredible experience, but it's actually you're at your most vulnerable in some way, because that's when you start to kind of question everything and really look at yourself and think, did I make it up? Is it true? So what did it mean for to have that hand, that bystander, to stop just looking and to actually help?
I think having one person refuse to believe in the distortion, refuse to believe in the lies. I don't know. It's strange. I don't feel like I need it now. I needed it so much then. And he hasn't done this because he wouldn't. But I think if he called me now and said, oh, you've made that whole thing up, I would now be able to say, oh, no, I know I didn't. You can think whatever you want. I know. But at the time, I was still very vulnerable to that. And I mean, I had journal entries about it. I had other women who had dated my brother who had contacted me and told me their own versions. And I was still incredibly vulnerable to just having someone come in and say, no, 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 that didn't happen. And I would say, oh, okay, I'm sure you know. And I think, yeah, having one other person just state the obvious, because that was the thing. In my family, my brothers struggle with these kinds of issues. It was the worst kept secret. I mean, nobody didn't know. if you know what I mean. Mm. I mean, it wasn't. I almost sometimes think my parents responded the way they did, not because they thought I was lying, but because they knew I wasn't.
Mm. Well, telling the truth seems to have been one of the biggest crimes in your family. Like, you could do everything else almost.
I really believe that if I had said what I'd said about my brother Tyler, I think I would have gotten a lot of help, you know, because everyone would have been like, well, it seems like maybe you're just not okay, because, you know, like, I think that they would be worried about me and they would want to make me feel listened to. And I almost think it was because there was this knowledge that it was true and this desperate need to cover it up, mm-hmm. that suddenly I became this dangerous thing that had to be dealt with in really extreme ways.
And your dad, who had been in a very, because he put himself in danger as well as all of you in danger. So he ends up in this explosion, a very serious, he nearly died and had these horrific burns on him. But he survived incredibly with your mother's herbs, really. You know, didn't go to hospital, did he? Or
it's the big, it's the story I always tell. Again, I think it's so hard for people to understand. Okay, you had all these injuries in the scrapyard because of just willful negligence. Obviously, he didn't care about you. And I say, no, he didn't put us through anything that he didn't put himself through. You know, he really believed, for one thing, he really believed that doctors were bad, they were evil, that you were so much worse off if you went to the doctor. And he really didn't understand safety and risk. And I think the biggest evidence for that is the worst injury that happened to any of us happened to him, because he decided if you're going to scrap a car, you really need to puncture the fuel tank and you need to drain all the fuel out of it, because they're not going to take a car that has a fuel tank on it. You drain the fuel out and then you can remove it. You can remove it with a cutting torch. You can remove it with tools. My dad, being my dad, decided, no, I don't need to puncture this tank and let the fuel out. Like, that's what pansy liberals do. I'll just take it off. And it exploded. And he was burned really, really badly. And of course, my parents made the decision to treat it at home with no IV, with no morphine. And he nearly died a couple times.
We didn't mention your mother's midwifery, because essentially she became a midwife at his kind of behest, because he wanted to make sure that when you guys got married and had children, that your mum would be able to deliver the baby, so you wouldn't have to rely on anybody. It's incredible that she actually went and did that. And at one point you were the midwife's assistant as a child.
I was more taken along for babysitting features. Like, if she was delivering someone's baby and they had children, sometimes, I think once or twice, I went along. I hated it. I really wanted to go. I begged her for ages. And then when she finally took me, I was like, this is weird. I don't want to do this.
But your mother wasn't into it either for a long time.
Like. No, but my mother is this incredibly competent person. And so she could just learn and become proficient at pretty much anything she wanted to. She, in just a matter of time, she could just sort it out.
It sounds a bit like you're a bit like that as well. Do you take that after?
I don't have a comment about that.
You're very good on going to Cambridge and going to those elite kind of educational institutions as somebody completely out of water, you know, as a complete fish out of water. And can you talk a bit about that, about what that's like and sort of what that experience is to be in a place where you know that pretty much everyone around you has had so much more than you have had and is coming from a completely different place?
I think if you're going to go to Cambridge or Harvard, going as a fish out of water is a pretty good way to go. And I think some people have terrible experiences that way and they don't feel like they are treated well. And I've talked to people like that. I didn't feel like that. I felt like I was treated very well. I think in some ways it helps to be American, because you cannot get placed so immediately by your accent. And that was a real benefit in a lot of ways. I was treated very well at Harvard. Harvard and Cambridge, they were really good experiences for me. And they were really safe places where I felt at home and people were kind to me and I was learning a lot. So it's a strange thing. I can see how peculiar they are. And I can see how isolated and elite they are in the positive sense and elite that they are in the negative sense. Mm-hmm. My experience of them was really positive.
Do you feel they should be much more open to more people? I mean, is that something that you're passionate about?
It's hard to see how that would hurt.
Okay, that's definitely a hell yes. Tell us about what you did there and what your achievements, your PhD, what was your doctorate in?
I did my doctorate on a very, you know, academic, minutia type thing, 19th century ideas about the family and socialist cooperative communes, if you really want to know. but I did do a chapter on Mormonism, which was which was good. It was great. I mean, I had stopped believing in Mormonism, not just the radical version of Mormonism that I'd been brought up with, but even mainstream Mormonism. And a lot of it for me had to do with this historical doctrinal. It was in the past, but it was still a doctrine in the church of polygamy, that in the afterlife, you would probably be a plural wife. And that was a real, Mormons would call it a stumbling block for me. I stumbled right over that block. And it was in a way great because I came from a tradition of, I mean, I had ancestry who had been plural wives who'd sacrificed a great deal to bring my family to the United States so that they could be Mormons. And in a way, I was grateful to have the chance to really examine the issue historically, philosophically, spiritually, and decide how I felt about it.
And we also should talk about you writing this book, because you did your doctorate, you had all the academia, you mastered the old essays, you were a master at that, and then you wanted to start to write, and you were in a writing group, and apparently Tara's writing group, when she started, they were all like, no, sorry, this is really crap.
Because it was. It was really bad, and I'm not a modest person, and it was really bad. It was really bad.
So I think with the typical, not that I know you very well, but I kind of know you a bit from reading your life story, you kind of immersed yourself in, how do I write this in the way that I want to write it? So tell us what you did, because I think there's probably a lot of people trying to write things as well themselves. And you went about it in quite an academic way, I think.
Well, I think I just went about it the same way that I had everything else. Because, again, I'm kind of grateful no one had ever sat me down and said, well, if you're going to be a writer, first thing, you have to read every book ever written, and you have to be, I think that there's a whole mythology around what you need to write, and it doesn't always make sense. Like, you have to be a prince like Nabokov, you have to be impoverished like Frank McCourt, you have to have this incredibly dysfunctional family so that you can write with depth and you can have human empathy, and then you have to come from a very functional family so that you're not insane, and just this like long list of requirements, and it's actually not possible. And then I think also just the idea that you can't, again, this whole idea of education that we have, that you can't learn things, you have to be taught things. And I think when I decided to learn how to write, I was especially grateful. I didn't know that you weren't able to teach yourself to write. Writers love to say that you can't teach writing, and they're probably right. You probably can't teach it, but I'm convinced you can learn it. And so for me, I think everyone's curriculum is going to be different. What I found really helpful, bizarrely, is the New Yorker Fiction podcast was kind of my Bible. Because, I mean, I'd never even heard of short stories until I decided to write a book. And then I thought, what is narrative arc? And I Googled it, and that was not helpful. So my next thought was, I'll read a bunch of novels, because I hadn't really read very many, because I'd been catching up on academic things. And so I thought, well, this is actually taking a long time. But then someone mentioned a short story. And I thought, well, that's shorter, and they'll have narrative arc in a smaller bite, and I'll get it. And it turned out to be totally true. And also, short stories are great because they are packed with technique. I mean, they are technically perfect, and they have to use a lot of tools just to function in that short amount of space. And the fiction podcast is particularly great because what you have is really great writers reading someone else's story, and then they discuss it with the fiction editor, and they explain to you why it works. And the particularly nice thing about it is there's, I don't know, 120 of these episodes. And some of them are really great writers, but I could care less about them. And I can just obsess over the 20 that I really like and figure out why they work.
And who were they, as a matter of interest? A couple of them.
Lori Moore, Tobias Wolff, Mavis Gallant. I became a bit obsessed with David Sedaris.
Oh, yeah. So I can see that.
I don't think most people find that kind of strange. I became obsessed with Joan Didion, but not her short stories, her essays. David Means. I don't think a lot of people read David Means, but he's actually genius.
We're all going to go and read him now.
He's really, really good.
But I just love the way you just analyzed all that, and then you just did it, and you used
those
techniques.
Well, I had them explain it to me. That's the thing. When Deborah Treisman says, did you notice this tense shift? Did you notice this point of view? Did you notice this very weird word that is a cognate is repeated in this other scene and how that links them? And I would always say, no, I did not notice that. But the next time I saw it somewhere, I would.
Yeah.
And then pretty soon, you're able to use it because it just enters into that toolbox of things that you understand. Mm. But for me, I think it takes a lot of repetition. And I never get that from reading anything once or even twice. I had an agent right after that. I actually found an agent. She said to me, "Oh, you must read so many books." And I said, "No, I read the same books many times." And that is completely true. I really don't read very widely. People are always shocked when they're like, "Haven't you read this book?" No, definitely haven't.
Well, listen, I'm going to open it to a couple of questions in a minute, but I do want to ask you, just to wrap up, about your parents now and the situation with your family and how you feel about it all. I read one interview where you spoke about you can miss people that, you know it's a pretty dysfunctional thing, but you can still miss people every day. Tell us about how you feel now about that estrangement and your hopes for maybe the future in terms of that.
I don't know what will happen in the future. I wanted to write the book without knowing. I guess I would say I wanted to write the book from that perspective of conflict, in the sense of inner conflict, of not having things be resolved. And I don't know how things will go with my family. I think for me, I feel like they would need to change for me to have a relationship with them. Not for me to love them necessarily, but for me to have them in my life. You know, I would need my dad to stop telling people I'm possessed, and I would need my brother to stop being violent. And it sounds like a joke, but those are literally the requirements. And I don't think that they're going to do that, but they might. And so, but the relevant factor isn't whether they will or won't. The relevant factor for me is I don't get to decide that. That's not under my power. There's really nothing I can do to push that one way or the other. And so the way I think of it is I will always be watching for signs that my family culture has changed, but I don't really wait for them, because it's just, I've just accepted whether my parents change or whether my brother changes, that's just not under my power.
And does any part of you yearn for that place that you grew up in, that sort of sees yourself walking back in those places again?
Yeah, and I think part of that is what I got from writing the book. I think I got to reclaim some of the good things about my life. You know, for a couple of years after I lost my family, I was really consumed with anger. And I think anger can be good. I have a theory about anger. I think it's a mechanism that your brain uses to get you out of situations that are bad for you, that might cause you harm. But once you're out, once you're safe, you don't necessarily need it anymore. You can get rid of it, live a better life without it. But in a way, it's almost because I'm not with my family, I don't need the anger. If I were still in that situation, I would need it. I would need it all the time. But writing the book, in a way, was a way for me to kind of go back and reclaim the good things that I had maybe forgotten or pushed aside when I was angry. And I felt like after I wrote the book, like I had become someone who had a beautiful childhood, but I was also someone who had a difficult childhood. And it seemed important to be able to have both of those, because you don't want to be someone who is blind to the bad, because that means someone is messing with your reality and they're either doing that to hurt you or to hurt someone else. But you also don't want to be someone whose whole life is bad memories and has no beauty in their life. So for me, the book was an important part of getting both of those things back.
Have they read it? And if so, would you ever think you'll hear what they thought of it?
About half of them. Actually, I don't know who's read it exactly. I know, I mean, the half I'm close to have definitely read it, and they read it when I first wrote it and they read drafts. And then the other half, I think some of them have read it, but they're definitely not supportive.
You know, you're in that phase of publication where everyone wants you, and you're, you know, it's the US and it's all these different countries and published in so many different languages. Are you enjoying that?
Yeah, I am enjoying it. I think it's, you know, it's memoir. There's something profoundly weird about it. but I don't regret doing it. You know, I'm glad I did it. And there were reasons that I did it. And those reasons haven't changed.
What would you say the main reason is?
I guess I can't even answer. There's two. Can I give two?
Yeah, you can.
I think
give
there's
two.
I think the personal reason I wanted to write it, I think, did have to do with getting back the good and holding the bad, fixing the bad in place, because I felt like I was getting constantly, the word that we like to use is gaslighting, but no one knows what that means. But it was constantly being moved. You know, things that were blue were constantly being called red. And I felt like I needed to fix it down so that I would stop struggling with myself over what happened. But then I also wanted to, I wanted to write about the good things, and I wanted to claim those back as well, because again, even that was eroding, because sometimes I was so angry I couldn't even remember the good things. So I wanted to fix that for myself. And then the other reason was when I was going through this experience of losing my family, I became so sensitive to the stories that are in the public sphere. And I think public stories are really important because they tell us who we are and they tell us how we're supposed to feel, when we're supposed to feel happy, when we're supposed to feel proud, when we're supposed to feel ashamed. And I did not feel like the stories I was encountering were telling me how I should feel with my situation. You know, how was I supposed to feel about myself and whether I was a good person when my mother didn't think I was, when my dad thought I was possessed? Am I supposed to be proud of this decision I'd made to stop seeing my parents? Am I allowed to be okay with that? Do I always have to feel guilty? I didn't feel like a lot of the stories, we had stories about family loyalty, but I didn't think we had stories about what to do with when loyalty to your family was in conflict with loyalty to yourself. And we had stories about forgiveness, but so many of them seem to conflate the idea of forgiveness with reconciliation, or to treat reconciliation as the highest form of forgiveness. And I felt like that was completely outside of my power. I had no idea if I would be able to reconcile with my family, but I wanted to believe that I could forgive them regardless of that.
Well, thank you very much for that. And I think on that second reason, I'm imagine that you're helping a lot of people, and I'm sure you've had feedback from people, letters and emails, who recognize some of the things, maybe not the particulars, specifics of what you've been through, but that separation. And I'm sure people are very grateful in many ways. I'm just very grateful that you've written an absolutely beautiful book that it's just such a pleasure to read. And everyone should just go and listen to the New Yorker podcast, and then we'll all be able to write like that. It'll be amazing. I don't think so. I wish it was that easy. Tara Westover, thank you so much. And thank you all for being here for the first live Roisin Meets. You've been an absolutely lovely audience. Thank you all very much. Thanks, Tara.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. I really hope you enjoyed our first ever Roisin Meets with a live audience. And thanks very much to the Gutter Bookshop. They're wonderful in there. Go and buy books in all the bookshops in your area. And I hope that's one of many live Roisin Meets that we'll be doing in the future. Thank you to my guest, Tara Westover, to her publishers, Penguin Random House, and as I said, to all the team at the Gutter Bookshop in Temple Bar, Dublin. Today's podcast was produced by Jennifer Ryan. I'm Roisin Ingle, and I'll talk to you next time. We'll